Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, TASS of Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. We are positively in the middle of Baltimore right now. We are here at beautiful Zeke's Coffee. We're on Harford Road. I believe they call this Lauraville. I call it Resigville. Mike Resigliano lives in the neighborhood. This whole thing sort of started with our friends at the Maryland Lottery, and I have brand new Lucky 7 doublers. Dan Rodrick is about to press his luck right now on the program. But we were down at Coco's last year, and Thomas Rhodes, who served a lot of coffee before a lot of Ravens road trips, said, you ought to come up here, have some coffee one Friday morning. We have this group that sits at the middle table, and Resig tells me about it. So I came up, had some coffee with them, and they're all going to gather here, because they gather every Friday, the neighborhood, and they do... you would call it a gripe session, a kibitz, a neighborhood thing. What is Andy Harris doesn't have those. What are they called? Town hall? We're here in Baltimore, Maryland. Dan Rodrick's, it needs no introduction. He has.
Man who needs no introduction.
I don't know what the. Yeah, I mean. My,
it's okay.
I don't even know how what to call you. People ask me about you. I'm like, he's sort of like the last crazy uncle I have. Jackman's dead. you know what I mean?
Henneman. Crazy uncle.
You know, you're still my alive.
You find me avuncular? That means uncle-like.
But people in my life that are your age that are like celebrity TV people or people that I knew or whatever, like I don't think of Marty Bass as an uncle. That's more like a cousin. But you, I grew up with you. You took me when I was a young man, and you don't remember this, that little cafe on Calvert Street, maybe the 300 block of Calvert Street. You took me in there.
The Bridge. The Bridge restaurant.
You took me in there for lunch one day, beleaguered.
Yeah.
And you were the guy on TV, and you were the columnist, and you were everything I wanted to be. I wanted to, like, figure out how to navigate this newspaper world and be great. I didn't want to be Mencken. I wanted to be Stedman. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
you wanted to write sports at first, right?
Yeah, that's all I ever wanted to do was write sports.
Well,
but then Jack Gibbons pulled me up and said, no, we're going to learn business. And I'm like... Who would want to read about that? And I'm like, well, if you want to get a football team back, you better understand bonding and money and the state house and government. And like, so I learned a lot of that through trying to steal a football team. And also, like, when I had a Pier 6 story and Pier 6 was going broke and I was on the music beat. And, you know, but I didn't do scandalous sports stuff except when Rob Deer got in a bar fight over at the Four Seasons.
Rob Deer. I thought you liked writing about rock and roll the best.
I liked writing, man. I just liked writing for a newspaper. I am that guy. Like, when I saw your stage show, that's all I ever wanted to do was get a byline and have my – that's all I dreamed of.
You mean –
this show.
Baltimore,
this show.
You have no idea?
This show. Yes, this show. Well, what are you working on, man, other than Democracy, which I could take you in a million different directions because since the last time we got together, you got a new stage show coming, you're writing a column, you're substacking, you're very relevant social media in the way that a deposed columnist from a newspaper would be. Cal is going to be here a little later on. We're all trying to make our own lane. We were talking about Mickey Coachella before you came on doing his podcast because we're all figuring out what our value is and where it is and what we want to do, but we all have... incredible value from having served in this media thing over the last five decades. I know that that's the value you bring to the table. I call it wisdom and trust and integrity, and that is the value.
Well, first of all, I wasn't deposed.
I walked
out of the Baltimore Sun after 48 years, and the last year of David Smith Sinclair ownership kind of threw me off, and I thought, it's a good time to leave. I've had 48 years here, and... 48 good years. I mean, I had a charmed life at the Baltimore Sun. I got to write a column. I got to write whatever I wanted to write about since I was 24 years old.
In your stage show, you still were shocked that they ever... I mean, it was sort of like when Henneman died, I talked a lot about this because I was a kid at the paper. Ken Rosenthal was coming in. And Jack Gibbons brought him in to be on the baseball beat.
Right.
And Henneman graduated sort of the national beat. I don't think Henneman loved that in the beginning because it was a beat thing or whatever. And he was such a young guy. I mean, Kenny was 23 years old. And, like, he's going to be the Oriole beat writer and he's this big and he looked like he was 12. But I think there's a point where I think of you in that way where they – was it Jack Lemmon? Who was the person that loved you?
There was a man named Philip Heisler.
And he was the one who fell in love with you.
He was the managing editor, yeah.
Didn't he go to Chicago maybe or something after that or no?
No, Phil Heisler was a longtime Baltimore Sun reporter, editor. He had been a World War II correspondent. And he was this sort of flinty, you talk about avuncular, uncle-like guy in the newsroom. Hard guy to get to know for some people, but for me, I mean, I took to him right away, and he liked me, and I was 24, and he asked me if I wanted to be a columnist. No, he didn't ask me if I wanted to be a columnist. He had made me a columnist. And I,
what do you think happened?
Well, when I was, I got to the Sun when I was 21, and I spent 3 years covering federal court and city hall, and general assignment, crime, fires, anything, you know, that they threw at me, especially federal court. So I proved myself as a hard news reporter, and then I would write feature stories. And I guess he liked the feature stories. So he thought the combination of somebody who could, you know, cares about the news and understands what news is and also can write in a feature style.
Which really speaks to your sense of humor to some degree.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, when you're covering hard news, there's none of that, right?
Well, it depends what you're covering. If you're covering a political corruption trial or something, that can lend itself to humor.
Well, this really strikes to where Jon Stewart and, you know, Keith Olbermann, just people that are in the space of Al Franken.
Stephen Colbert.
Stephen Colbert, yeah. We'll get to him in a minute. Yeah. We'll be getting him probably all day as Rasig walks in the door.
Yeah.
But there is, and we were even talking about Mickey Coachella, comedy sort of the other part of this, that you do have a perspective and a point of view at 24, be it good, bad, or ugly.
Okay, except one thing. I didn't think anybody cared what I had to say at 24. All right, so I had not formed a lot of opinions about Baltimore yet. I'd only been in town for 3 years. I was still a kid, right? So I took it easy. I decided to just write really good sort of like featurey kind of columns, you know, offbeat stories that other people didn't have.
Man about town, right?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And
okay.
Then I slowly developed a voice, you know, which is
right.
Still breaking. I slowly developed a voice in the column so people understood where I was coming from. And I'll tell you what, if you want to learn about a city quickly, become a newspaper reporter or any kind of reporter. I mean, every day is different. Every day you're in a different part of town, meeting new people. In my case, trying to get over the language barrier, you know. So it was.
It's not the heat.
It's the humility.
It's the humility, of course.
So, yeah. So I learned fast. I learned quickly about the city. And then people started calling me with stories, you know. But over time, I developed stronger opinions about things, and then I felt more confident in expressing them. But I wasn't that way at 24.
Okay, so 48 years, you did 45 as a columnist, right?
No, I did.
How many did you do?
I'm sorry. I started in 79 and ended in 2025. So that's 46 years.
And so 43 as a columnist then, or whatever the number was, right?
No, it's 46 years as a columnist.
So oh, geez.
48 years
right.
as a...
You got here in 76 and became a columnist in 79.
Yeah, 76, almost 49 years at the Sun. Yeah, almost 50.
I don't even know what to say. Like, if you and I were to sit here and do this all weekend, if we were to do a marathon Baltimore thing, just talking about what you found
decade
with Schaefer and how Harbor Place has come and gone.
Yeah.
Camden Yards is coming. Now they're going to try to wreck it again. And new scoreboard's going up and they're putting money in.
Yeah.
And we didn't have the Colts, and then they were... Colts were great when you got here. It was Burt Jones. It was like all that, right?
Right.
And then that's gone.
And then that went away.
There's a whole
different
thing. But not only that, leadership, political leadership, corruption, just all of the bridge falling.
There's so many stories.
But to encompass all of that.
That's why I never left, because there's never been a dull moment in Baltimore, as far as I'm concerned. As far as news goes, as far as talking about what's happening politically in the government and in the community with sports. Come on. Really. I mean,
there's something going on every day.
There's something all the time. Yeah, really. Yeah. Oh. And you know, this play that I did, we talked about before on your show.
I love, by the way.
And I appreciate your support of it. It's a play based on stories that I wrote over the years at The Sun. And then the second play we did, Baltimore Docket, was based on all the court trials that I, not all of them, but several court trials that I covered and observed and wrote about. But now I just finished working on a third play, which would make it my plays of Baltimore trilogy, about something that occurred before I got here. So I was very curious about what Baltimore was like in the 60s, you know, before the 68 riots, the death of Dr. King and the riots that broke out. What about those years just before that? The year the Orioles won the World Series, 66, that seemed like a good year to focus on. What was the city like in that year? You know, I really didn't know, you know. And then there's this mayor, Mayor McKeldin, Theodore Roosevelt McKeldin, the last Republican mayor of Baltimore. What was he like? What was going on here? So that's what got me into the third play. So the third play is different than the first two, and then it's not about my experience. It's about what I discovered about Baltimore as a researcher.
And, are you the narrator?
Yeah, I narrate. I serve as a narrator in the play. But the play is more of a conventional play with, you know, someone playing Frank Robinson, someone playing Brooks, someone playing...
Okay.
Someone playing...
Can I play Louis? Let me make a cameo.
Louis Aparicio is mentioned, but he's not... He's definitely mentioned
right.
in the play.
Well, I like that.
So the play deals,
I already like the play.
Yeah. It deals with the 66 Orioles and what was going on in the city politically in terms of racial politics and the civil rights movement. And this guy, McKeldin, which... I don't know how much you know about him. I didn't know very much.
I know Peter Angelos ran for mayor that year, and I have the placard for it. Angelos for mayor. Angelos for whatever, for freedom. It said for freedom on it.
Yeah.
I tried to put it up on your thing, but your Facebook didn't take pictures. But
what year do you think that was?
He ran 62, 66?
63.
63. All right. Well,
yeah. No, that was the year.
He ran twice, so yeah.
So... He must have run in the Democratic primary.
I think he ran 63, 67 then. Right. He ran twice, but go ahead.
Okay. So he ran in the Democratic primary and he lost.
Oh, yeah.
So Mayor, Theodore McKeldin, who had been governor of Maryland, came back to become mayor again. He was a mayor in the 40s, governor in the 50s, and then he made a comeback.
So that would have been like Schaefer coming back and running the city again instead of being the controller. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And he ran against a guy named Philip Goodman. And he beat Goodman in 63. So he was the last Republican mayor of Baltimore. And this guy was he was not like any Republican you see today. Unlike any Republican you see today. He was a moderate, liberal, and a progressive on civil rights. In the 50s, when he was governor.
Against redlining in the 60s, really? Or just theoretically?
He was for open housing.
Or just said he was.
You'll see. You'll discover.
Okay.
That's the neat thing about the play is you're going to learn.
I love learning. That's why I bring Dan Rogers here.
Yeah.
We are doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour today at Zeke's Coffee. Dan is enjoying some Zeke's Coffee. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. I got some leftover back to futures. I got some lucky seven. These are the new ones, the pressure luck. So we're giving these out all day long here. I'm having coffee. We've already delicious apple Danish we've had already.
We just shared an apple Danish. You had a little bit more than...
I told you to give me a third. You gave me 40% because you're very generous and you come from a Portuguese family. You want to feed me. You want pastéis de nata is what you want here. 66. Let's finish up on the 66 and your play work. We haven't been fishing together lately. We haven't caught. I mean, last time I saw you was Christmas time with Gertrude's with John Shields before you ran it again.
We've done this three times now, this play.
Are you doing it again Christmas?
Okay, so the schedule.
Give me where we are.
So the new play is called.
We had one other one. You had a second one. Hold on. You had a courtroom
docket.
One.
Baltimore
Docket. That's dark right now.
Yeah, that'll
okay.
be dark.
Okay, I'm just checking.
Yeah.
All right.
That needs some revision.
You've done three plays now. They're just starting to get
We've done this one
original.
Three times. Mm-hmm. We did Docket once. So we've done four performances at the Baltimore Museum of Art of two plays. And
in the theater I didn't even know existed. It's beautiful.
It is a really nice theater.
Right above Gertrude's. Yeah. My God, what a great
Yeah, you can
venue.
Go to the museum.
We did.
And walk around the museum.
I brought everybody I knew to your show.
I know.
And we had crab cakes from Fadley's. It was our Christmas party, holiday event for all my crew and my A-list. Because I said to all of them, you're going to learn. That's what I said. You're going to learn about my town.
Yeah.
I brought John Martin, executive director of the Maryland Lottery. That night, because he's from Ohio, mm-hmm. and I said, you got to come see this show, because he loves sports, he likes, you know, he likes to learn about Baltimore, and I said, you'll learn more, and we all laughed, we all cried, we cried too much, I cried the second time, I didn't see Docket, it was on a weird timing, and you only ran it for like a minute and a half or something,
well,
right?
We did six performances in February 24.
Six performances, that's six nights, and I got to figure one of them out, and for whatever reason, I wasn't around.
Yeah.
I was figuring, well, he'll just bring it back, and instead...
Well, we might, but I moved on to a third idea.
Well, right, you told me that a year ago. At Christmas, you were like, I got this 66 idea. So it's done, it's written, as you see
it. Yeah, we're casting it now. Yeah.
And this will run in when?
Next March.
Are you doing this at Christmas again,
We're not doing this year. We're skipping this year because I need to focus on the March play.
So there's no December play?
No, but there will be December of 26. We bring this back.
All right, so you've got the next year. You're like,
yeah.
You're like Coldplay. You got to get your tour dates out ahead
yeah,
of time.
26.
Year ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's one more thing.
Okay.
So I can slip it on the show.
Okay. Did you tell Mickey this?
No. This has.
Okay. Mickey.
This hasn't been announced yet.
Sinestro
and it
exclusive.
Hasn't been finalized yet.
All right.
But a professional theater in Baltimore is sort of. I don't know if they're commissioning me, but I'm writing a one-man play, separate from this and separate from the March play.
Is this like Springsteen? Like
yeah,
a one-man
yeah,
play?
Yeah, it'd be sort of like that, except without a guitar. And
yeah, right, you know, right.
Right.
Well, Patty did come out and sing with him every night. So.
Yeah. So we're talking with the Everyman Theater in downtown Baltimore about doing a one-man show separate from the play that I did that might incorporate some elements of Baltimore, you have no idea, but it'll be in the summer of. So I have a busy year next year in 26.
All right, so you have gone out of this column, this lane,
yeah.
into. Well, you're still writing.
I'm still writing.
Yeah, you still write as much as you ever write, right? Literally.
I feel like I'm writing more than I did when I was at the Sun.
Well, I feel that way.
I write for Baltimore Fishbowl.
I feel like Olesker writes more than he ever did when he was at the paper. I mean, stuff shows up, and it's nice.
That's a beautiful thing. I mean, we did write 3 times a week, you know. But
your social stuff, you put pictures up 10 times a week of just things that inspire. That purple building over there, you'll see it, and you'll be like, hey, I like the way that looks. I like the color composition. You put picture of your fish up.
The world is interesting, and I'm still a journalist. Aren't we journalists? You observe, you tell people stories.
People tell me, stay in my lane, stick to sports, and, I just say, that's not going to happen around here. You know.
Oh, yeah, I would get that sometimes from...
Because I'm not human, I'm not a citizen.
Yeah.
We'll get into democracy in a minute. I mean, I wanted to, like, get all of Dan out first,
yeah.
and then I want to get into Colbert journalism, my FCC license... You know, just basic things that, like, I'm in business with Donald Trump, whether I want to be or not, apparently. So just what happened with CBS, I find to be appalling. What happened at the Baltimore Sun? Like, what's Cal's going to come in here in a little while, and the two of you are the most decorated Baltimore Sun walking billboards for the Baltimore Sun who walk through the city. I can't trust it anymore, right? You know? And when you can't trust it, when you get to be this age and you don't trust it and your instinct, not my instinct, my facts, this isn't about do I think he's a good guy or a bad guy, is the information true or not?
Well, here's,
and we never sweated that on Calvert Street
when I worked there. No, that's going to say, I never remember reading my newspaper, The Sun or The Evening Sun, when we published an Evening Sun, and thinking, I don't trust this story. Having a question about the motive behind the story. Why are we publishing this story? It struck me, I think it was this past spring, a story about, even though crime is down in Baltimore significantly, you know, there's still this perception of crime. So we have this story about it. I say we because even though I'm not at the Sun anymore, I still say we. A story about a perception of crime, quoting a store owner in Fells Point on a Wednesday afternoon in spring, complaining that there was no traffic for her souvenir shop on a Wednesday in Fells Point in the afternoon. And using this as an example of how business is down in Fells Point and people are afraid to come downtown, I said, what is the... This seems like a stretch story to prove some point. And I don't remember thinking that about stories that appeared in our paper in the past. Reading a story and saying, "What? Why did we do this story? What's the motive behind this?" And when you have an ownership that has a certain agenda of viewpoint and imposing it on the news department, that's when I say,
I tell you what, it's bled into my world, not just being thrown out after 35 years of dedicating my life to covering Baltimore sports professionally and owning an FCC license and employing half the city, but it's really the last year, the Justin Tucker thing and how that's been handled by other media organizations, you know, like the Banner reported 7 and then 5 or 16 women.
Yeah.
I went up on the WJZ's website. I went up on the WBAL's website.
Yeah.
No mention after the first story. The secondary and tertiary stories, no mention. They did, however, put a headline up, Tucker denies everything, and smeared the journalists within moments.
Oh, really?
Oh, Tucker smeared the journalists within you, 5 minutes of so the story coming out.
I didn't pay attention. You mean the local TV stations, these two stations you mentioned?
I'm talking about their websites, not just the television stations.
Just, like, ignored the story except for the denial? And then what?
There was a first story, and then the follow-up was five more, and the follow-up was seven more women coming forward.
That was from the banner.
Right.
Yeah.
The follow-up stories never appeared on BAL or Jay-Z because the Ravens tightened the grip on journalism. And I know this because I've been on the inside of it. I know what that intimidation looks and feels like.
Yeah.
You know, I get it from the current governor's office right now, even though I supported him. Because I had some things to say about the Maryland Stadium Authority. So these games that they all play, that I don't know that you would tell me differently about Schaefer or Harry Hughes or Marvin Mandel, you know, 50 years ago about how it was supposed to be played with communications. But Trump has turned the whole world upside down as far as what fake news, what people believe that walk by.
Before you even get to that, though, I found the corporations that run football and baseball, MLB and the NFL, and then the Ravens and the Orioles, very tightly control access to players, for instance, if you want to interview players. It used to be sort of wide open. You just show up and interview somebody. And now, and especially in football, it became very controlled. So you had to sort of play ball, play nice to get what to get an interview.
How do you play nice with a kicker who's been a sexual predator in the city for 15 years? You know, how do you play nice with that story?
No. I mean, playing nice in general.
How do you play nice when they get $600 million?
Yeah.
You know, and then say we're a private company. No, you took $1.2 billion of civic money.
Yeah.
Have a real press conference. Have a real press conference.
Did you? I mean, I know you have problems with access. I thought sometimes it's too controlling. It's hard. Like, we're journalists. We just want to talk to people and get stories.
Baltimore CEO Club, guy named Doug Strauss. I've actually been a speaker for them. Last year told me I wasn't allowed to come to a luncheon and pay because Sashi Brown and Chad Steele said he's media. And I'm like, I'm not media. They threw me out. I'm not even real media. So I'm not media. I'm not citizen. I'm not allowed to buy a ticket on a golf course to do a public event where the president of the Baltimore Ravens, who's making $2 million a year, speak. Where are we? I mean, I'm a 35-year journalist. That's so you wonder where Colbert is or wonder where Dan Rodgers is not in the Baltimore Sun anymore or how Cal became deposed, right?
I left on my own.
Like, I know you, but they would have thrown you out, right?
No,
don't think so?
No, I don't. Well.
Seriously?
If I was writing every day, like I'm writing on Substack now about national affairs, about Trump, I may not have lasted.
If you wrote about how your own paper was screwed up, you would have been gone, right? Yes, that's what Colbert did. Colbert said, my bosses were bribed. Like, basically.
I thought Colbert was saying, he knew he was going to get fired. He wanted to go out in a blaze of high integrity.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think he knew that was going to happen.
After 60 minutes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We can't trust 60
Paley.
Minutes, dude? I mean, what have we done if we can't trust 60 minutes?
If we can't trust
the Baltimore Sun.
I mean, CBS, Edward R. Murrow is on the Mount Rushmore of journalism. So, it's not a good thing. It looks, to me, it's a combination of a Hobbs Act violation by Trump, which is extortion, or a bribe. You know, those things are different. Extortion means, you know, you squeeze somebody for a bribe. A bribe means you just offer it to somebody to get what you want.
That's why I bring a real journalist here, because we need to decide whether the president's bribing or whether...
Whether he's extorting.
Extorting, sorry.
I thought he extorted money from law firms. That whole thing with the law firm...
He kind of created an insurrection and people died on this. It kind of put wind into that, wouldn't you say?
Oh, but some of the law firms paying for the library or whatever they're paying into in order to get federal contracts, in order to get access... As lobbyists, a lot of attorneys are lobbyists to the federal government. Otherwise, they were going to block them out unless they paid money. You know, so to me, it looked like extortion. And then the CBS Paramount thing looked like extortion again. You get $16 million at the Trump Library, or you don't get your merger. I mean, what the hell is this? It's like open. It's just like street crime.
Yes.
It's just
well,
out
that's
there
the
in
world
the
he comes from, though, right?
I mean, well, he's so more blatant about it because he controls the Justice Department. He has an attorney general. He just pushes her
what
around.
Difference
tells her what
difference does it make? This week, as we sit here, last month it was Elon Musk. 2 weeks, you know, every week it's a reality show. This week it's Epstein, right? Right.
Yeah.
So like, there's no question he was on that island. There's no question that he was on planes. There's no doubt about any of this.
You mean Trump?
I mean Trump's involvement in this.
He was a friend of Jeffrey. They were best friends and pals for 10 years.
So we prove it. Great. You prove that. So what does that mean to the electorate? He's been impeached twice the last time around. Nobody's even going to bother to impeach him. I mean, we've really created a very ugly monster here, Dan.
It's a lawless administration. It's terrible. There's two things that really bother me the most are the cutoff of money the destruction of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, where we're actually committing, I don't want to call it homicide, but people are dying as a result of the sudden cutoff of the foreign aid to some of the poorest countries in the world, the poorest people in the world, that were relying on USAID, food and medical assistance. And it wasn't that much money when you look at the whole federal budget, but Elon Musk did that.
But when you have no moral compass, I mean, these are people without a moral compass. I mean, that's really, at the base of it, that's the thing that the red hat people running around spouting nonsense that they read on the internet that they trust more than Dan Rodrick's, right? Yeah. Like, it's insane to me, but the ideology when I speak to these people or when they hit my Facebook page with the election was fixed in 20, just outlandish.
What's the ideology behind cutting off medicine to keep people from dying of AIDS, millions of people, and food for children in sub-Saharan Africa who would die otherwise? What do the red hats say about that? Oh, we have to take care of
ourselves?
They're
Christian.
That's what the answer would be.
This thing
troubles me so much because of the sudden cutoff. And Musk did it. And Musk did it, I guess, with the approval of Trump. And
Stephen Miller.
He's another one. Yeah, that gets us over to the immigration story.
Yeah, Pee Wee German.
Which is the other thing that really, really should bother people. Now, you know, a man wrote to me this morning.
Son of immigrants?
Yeah, son of a immigrant. A grandson of immigrants. A man wrote to me this morning and said, why do you make ICE agents the bad guys when they're just trying to enforce the law against people who entered the country illegally? I don't dispute that they entered the country unauthorized, right? We've got like 11 million people living in the country who came in without documentation, right? They've been living among us, working out here. I've seen them working on the median strip on Harford Road.
I said to one of these creeps that hit my Facebook page last week, I said, you haven't had a meal in this century
that wasn't touched by an
immigrant, either documented or probably undocumented.
Right. So we've abided this for years, right? Okay. We just know they're there and they're doing their work. Not only doing their work, they're paying taxes. They pay into the Social Security Trust Fund. There was a year when the former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, said if not for undocumented immigrants paying into the Social Security Trust Fund, it would have been insolvent in a particular year. That was like 10, 12 years ago. But ever since then, they still pay in. They get tax ID numbers, TINs, and pay.
They have everything
taxes.
But the right to vote, right?
Literally. Yeah, they can't vote, right. And they're not citizens. So the smart thing to do is just acknowledge that, like, you get 11 million people here. Instead of going through this whole process of deporting, and I'm not against deporting people who break the law. I mean, that's what Obama did that, and all the presidents have done that. There's a process for doing that. But what we're doing now is masked thugs going around and grabbing people who are not breaking any laws.
The people they're grabbing could have been me in 1975, because my old man was Venezuelan. He don't speak no good. He come here in 1966 in the Oriole, play shortstop.
Yeah.
Dan Rodrick's right play about this, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would have been... My father would have been the one getting picked up at Pantry
Stopped
Pride.
On the street, yeah.
You know, he had a green card, right? Yeah. You know, at that point, my father, you know, my brother, however, did not. You know, when he came years and years ago, lived here 30 years. He's now a citizen. Right. Came, went about things the way he could when he got here. But
so, what's the solution for this? So some would say, okay, well, what are you supposed to do with these people who are in the country illegally?
Illegal aliens.
All right. Well, I say, okay, here, you could do this to settle this whole thing. You could do what Ronald Reagan did in 1987, 88, and 89. Not in 89, I'm sorry. In 86, 87, 88. Amnesty. You offer amnesty to people who are in the country without authorization. You say, you come forward, come to an immigration office. We're not going to arrest you. We're going to process you. We're going to put you on a path to citizenship. Every economist you talk to says that these 11 million people who are in the country, half
we can't run the country without them.
No, you need, you. Yeah.
Let's start with that.
They need to pick the lettuce. They need
any
to,
of the
they
idiots
clean our,
out there yeah. that want to play the rhetoric and play the Rush Limbaugh game and play yeah. the racist game and all of that.
It is racist.
We can't run the country without them.
Yeah. Every economist, well, almost every economist will tell you that.
Well, that one's not employed by Trump.
And that you can't expect more than 2% growth in a year without more immigrants.
You know, I have conversations with people, too. Last week, Bill Cole and I were having a coffee off the air, not even on the air, just about the youth in a society that immigration brings younger people.
Oh yeah.
And without that, you become Japan and you become an Orioles game. You become old, white, and tired.
Yeah, and you don't have anyone to take care of you. I mean, in Spain, they brought in young women from Brazil to take care of the elderly of Spain because of the birth rate, and there weren't enough immigrants going
Every
into Spain.
Woman that worked, and they were all women, well, a couple of men, that worked in my mother's facility at the end of my mother's life were African or some version of Haitian. You know, Caribbean, they were black, they were, you know, dark-skinned people with an accent that bordered on French or Caribbean or Creole or African in some way. Mm-hmm. Every person I met who cared for my mother at the end of her life was from that part of the world. And all decorated nurses in their culture and came here just to be care providers, even though they were a registered nurse in Sierra Leone. Where, you know, places that Trump is literally killing people now.
Those are shithole countries. Ian.
Right, exactly.
Well, they look past all of that, all of this logic to just get rid of brown and black people who, you know, whose status
and
frighten in the country,
all the rest of them.
Well, it's very,
Well, the real story is you were in Colgate the other day, by the way.
The cruelty is the whole point.
My
right?
son lives in Colgate. Yeah. By the way, the video you shared of the man standing in the garden was sort of the Buddhist vibe about him, talking about the psychology of what's allowed Trump to work.
Oh, yeah. That
the
was 14 that
minute video.
Yeah,
I watched it yesterday morning. I wanted to watch it, and I'll share it. And so I think
he was dealing with the question of why is MAGA so cruel? Why are they into the alligator Alcatraz thing? What's with all this cruelty?
I want to say something about my son. We were down at Costas in Dundalk about 8 weeks ago. Having a delicious hito. We ran into Congressman Olszewski there while we were there, who did the show last week, and we had a long conversation about the same topics. And my son went to Amsterdam 2 years ago. My son likes to travel, and they did the Anne Frank house. I had been to Amsterdam 5 times, you know, having fun, doing Amsterdam stuff in Europe, went to soccer, and I'd never gone to Anne Frank until 3 years ago. I went to the Anne Frank house.
Oh, did you?
And I went up in that house, and I got trapped in that room, and I came out. I was a mess for 6 hours. I was a mess for 6 weeks when I got back. My son sat at the bar at Costas as it closed about 8 weeks ago, and he said, Dad, everybody in our neighborhood's Hispanic. My elementary school was 72% Hispanic now. The one I went to that I was 1% Hispanic, me. And Spanish is the language spoken in the neighborhood of Colgate that I grew up in, right where Mickey Coachella does his podcast, East Point Mall. And my son said, it's like Anne Frank in our neighborhood, Dad. Everybody's got the shades pulled down.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's afraid that I'm the gringo that might rat them out, that's going to call ICE. And what the rednecks do to torture the Hispanic people is say, I'm going to call ICE on you. That is the not stay in your lane, not stick to sports, not I'm calling the FCC, which I've had all of that, right? But I'm going to call ICE on you. That's what they would have threatened my father with in 1975 with his little seven-year-old Nestor running around. Like, that's such dog shit that I can't
I don't know how you can be an American and feel like this is – be comfortable with this. I don't get it. What skin off your nose is it if a guy from Guatemala who has a wife and a couple of kids is mulching the lawns at Towson University? I mean,
and his children are going to school with your children.
Yeah, I mean, what do you care? Why does this bother you?
And he's come here to make a better life for his daughter and his son.
Oh, no. So this gets me – do you mind? I wanted to
– So go.
I wanted to tell you one other thing.
I want your soliloquy, man.
One thing about immigration that maybe people don't think about that you could think about. I've spoken several times with an economist from University of California named Giovanni Perry, who does a lot of field investigations on immigration. He looks at regional labor markets and looks at trends in them. And
one of the where farming communities and like that kind of thing, agricultural.
Wherever he looked at
where are the jobs?
He looked at the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
Someone comes across the border, where are they going to go work? Is that
where do they go to work? But the question is, do they displace American workers?
Okay.
And where you have a lot of immigrants in a economy, a regional economy, like the Greater Baltimore area or the Eastern Shore, does that help the economy, or is it just, is it a neutral result? And this is an interesting thing. He looked at the crab pickers on the Eastern Shore. He said in the earlier generation, the crab pickers were white, because that's the poorer whites who picked crabs in crab houses on the Eastern Shore, or shucked oysters. And then the next generation, they were black. And black women especially would pick crabs in crab houses. Well, he said, when you have a influx of immigrants from Central America, for instance, who come into crab houses and pick the crab houses, the daughters of those black women who work there are now like teaching, or they've got a professional job someplace else, or they've elevated up. They're actually making more money than their mothers did picking crabs, and their mother
picked crabs so they could go to school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get literally educated, right?
Go to college.
American dream of every immigrant.
Yeah. Yeah. Or develop a trade or a craft and move on. Have your own small business, right? Well, so in that sense, the immigrants, I use crab picking as an example, but there are other examples around the country where actually salaries have grown. There's increased prosperity among people who are already established citizens because you have a immigrant class that's moved in to take jobs that the previous generation, your parents did or your grandparents did.
But those jobs still exist where the factory job in Aliquippa or in Bethlehem.
Those are gone.
That's gone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there was the coal mines, right?
Yeah.
Like those places didn't have crabs coming out of the water. So let's cut down trees. Let's do the next thing we can do here.
Right.
A lot of places, I mean, Dan, you drive out to Western Maryland, there's just a lot of places where it's not the city, it's the farm. And
it's agricultural. The mining has gone away. So people have to find, but a tourist economy developed out there. So it's agriculture and tourism. That's something that tourism is the last half a century or so that's been big, right? Where coal mining has been on the way out. And there were, immigrants who worked in the coal mines. Where are their kids today? They moved away from there. They moved up. They left because they didn't want to work in the coal mine.
Well, it was also about the train, too, right? It was all that whole part of the world, living near a train, working at a factory where there was a train to take things, right? The B&O and like the whole thing.
About
100 years ago,
right?
It was
an industrial age.
That's how those things.
What I mean
that's why those towns existed, though, right?
Yeah.
Because they were on the water or they were on the rail,
yeah.
right? And then when there's no need for whatever or a thing not there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then it gets something else takes its place, usually, right?
Oh, see, something's taking my place here is a chicken sandwich. Thank you, sir.
Oh, that's a chicken biscuit?
Yeah, I told him to send it over at 8:45, and it's 8:46.
Wow.
So I wanted you to finish your soliloquy on immigration.
Well, that's...
And then I'm going to eat this thing. My God,
I
look
just
at this.
I just don't understand why we're going through all this. Hello, Michael.
Oh, we're six here. Here we go.
Hey. I don't... You can put that down there. No, I was just finishing. I've said my piece
sticky.
Here. I wrote a piece on Substack yesterday, really just for the hell of it. I don't know that it will do any good. I don't know that anything I write does any good, but It was an appeal to ICE agents because I'd watched...
That you might be Nazis in the end. In the end, you might be committing crimes. Not you are committing crimes.
Yeah, I looked
and
up...
And if not, yeah. Psychological crime to yourself. That was your point, right?
Somebody told me... That's right.
I read your piece.
Somebody told me about this thing called moral injury, and I'd never thought about it before. Soldiers suffer from PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And some of them, it results in suicide, depression. Some actually kill themselves. It's terrible. It's been a real serious problem for a long time. But it's more of it, more veterans are being treated for it, which is good, right? But right alongside that, according to these clinicians who studied these guys, who've been in war zones and seen atrocities, either didn't commit them but saw them, in some cases committed them.
Did commit them, yes.
There's this thing called moral injury where you sort of lost your guidance system. You don't know what's right, what's wrong anymore. You don't know who to trust. You feel betrayed by, say, a military leader who sent you out to do something.
Or I did this for that flag and what that flag stands for in many cases.
Yeah, and now it doesn't make sense to me. Or it seems morally reprehensible to me. The betrayal thing is a big thing, like apparently with guys who have this problem.
Well, in the military, too. It's
yeah,
part of
you feel betrayed by an officer who sent you to do something you shouldn't have done, that he should not have sent you to do. And I'm looking at some of these ICE agents now. Some
just
of them,
following orders, right? That's what it is,
well,
right?
I mean, they're making good money walking around with the balaclava, you know, with the mask on, and they're not fully identified. They don't have warrants. They're doing warrantless arrests. There's a
they're
lack.
They're bounty hunter thugs at this point, I mean, employed
it,
by the government.
What does
right?
it look like to you? That's what it looks like to me.
Where's due process?
Well, that's being challenged in court, fortunately. But a lot of those guys originally, the Venezuelans, they sent them to...
That's my people, by the way.
They sent them to El Salvador without any due process, right? And then Stephen Miller says that he's thinking of asking Congress to suspend due process. What? Suspend the Constitution so you can just purge immigrants out of the country?
It's a little Goebbels, isn't it? It's, you know. Yeah. Dan Rogers is here. We're at Zeke's Coffee. We're about to eat whatever this... delicious thing that America allows us to eat, which is, looks like an egg, a biscuit, it looks like some chicken. Going on here,
yeah.
And it looks like, it might be some hot honey, I'm going to have to, hold on, let me see.
Yeah, there's some honey on there?
It's got a kick. I got some hot coffee here. We're going to come back, it's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. Dan's going to press his luck with another segment. We have the Lucky Sevens Doublers as well. Rasig is here, Thomas Rhodes is here, Cal, can I call him deposed? Is he going to take umbrage to that?
Yeah, well, he was deposed. He was fired.
Yeah.
He
okay.
Was, yeah, I walked out. I just
because you have a moral whatever. What was your last comment yesterday? You said the moral. You didn't want to do things.
Moral injury.
Yeah, you didn't want moral injury.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have been moral injury for them to come in and tell you need to become a conservative or pretend to be one, right?
Oh, I wouldn't have done that.
Right.
No.
Right.
I had a good life at the Sun. I had I had 47 great years there.
And he's had 47 great minutes here. We're
so
here at Zeke's Coffee. We're on Harford Road in beautiful Lauraville. It is, become the front. It's gotten loud in here since you sat down.
Yeah.
And we had our first Apple Danish. Back for more. We're going to talk, about Baltimore and how much we love it. Stay with us.